And the title of my talk, as you know, is Speculations on a Speculum, and just talking about some basic things in gynecology. What I'm going to talk about tonight is annual exams and why we do what we do, how we do what we do, why it's important, why you need to have it done, and how it makes you feel, and what you can't stand about it, and what makes you angry about it, and what makes you angry about going to see your gynecologist or your nurse practitioner or whoever it is that you go to see, and some of the feelings associated with some of those things. So I want to say that about myself, a lot of people go, ooh, well, how did you ever get into this field? Especially when I'm about to do their pelvic exam, they go, why did you ever go into this field? they can't quite understand that. And one of my key interests is the association between our bodies and our self-esteem, and I think that that's a real big piece of the picture for women. It's a big issue. And I think the more that we know about our bodies and the way they work, that has a lot to do with how we feel about ourselves. It has a lot to do about what kind of sense of control we have over our lives. The oft-quoted phrase that biology is destiny. And I think that for women for centuries, biology has been destiny. And I think until we have a pretty good understanding of our biology, it will continue to be destiny. But I think that we can make some decisions and make some choices about what happens in our lives and with our bodies. And the more we know about that, the more we're able to do that. And I think that's true at any stage of our life. And I think especially in this culture, because we have so many cultural expectations about our body and so much information we get from the media about our bodies, and I think it's real important to get sort of the basic information about really what our bodies do and how they work so that we can feel more in control and not have to rely on all those very conflicting messages that we get from the media. This session is being taped, and if at any point people want to make comments or have questions that you don't feel comfortable having on the tape, just say, just stop it, and we'll turn it off, because I don't want that to inhibit people's ability to talk about some of these issues. The other thing that, giving people a sense of control about their body and empowering them, and as I said, building self-esteem, I think one of the important things about it is, and one of the places that I feel it's most important to be helping women with education about these issues, that is at times of transition. And I think for women, they're in transition sort of throughout their entire life, so that's kind of all the time. But the transitions that I see where it makes a big difference in people's self-esteem is for young women who are first starting to have their periods, young women when they're first becoming sexually active, young women who are considering getting pregnant, young women who are having problems with infertility. And then as women age, women who are having problems, either sexual problems or starting new relationships and first starting to have a sexual relationship if they hadn't for a long time, or if they're exploring different aspects of their sexuality. All those are times, I think, where it's really important to get some basic grounding and some good information about really what's going on with our body, again, as a way of feeling better about ourselves and having a sense of control about what's going on. And one of the things that I see in my practice, I work in Seattle with a largely, I'd have to say, middle-class group of people. I work with Group Health Cooperative, and so it's all people who are employed and have insurance. And that I find sort of frightening is that it seems like the younger the women are, the less they know about their bodies. And that, I don't know if that's really tied with having less self-esteem, but I also see that a lot, too. And I mean, I feel like it's frequently the women who come in, young women who are very, very self-confident, that are the ones that know the most about their bodies, and I just see that connection all the time. I find that real frightening for young women, because they're certainly the ones that are most at risk for a lot of sexually transmitted diseases. They're most at risk for being in exploitive relationships when they don't know about their body and when they don't have that kind of self-esteem. So I think that is one of the key reasons why I think it's really important to do sex education and to teach women about their bodies and to give them that sense of control, to empower them, to make them more powerful people in sexual relations and in their lives. One of the things I wanted to talk about tonight is sort of the history of women's health care. To begin with, there's sort of two veins of women's health care, and there's sort of the women taking care of women side of it and the men taking care of women side of it. And on the women taking care of women side of it, there have been the traditional healers that have been in almost every culture. And those have been the midwives. In some cultures, they may have been called witches, in some cultures, midwives, nurses, but also grandmothers and mothers transmitting information to their daughters. And in Western culture, we've really lost a lot of that, and we've given that over to the medical field, and we've given that over to professionals, and to some extent, we've even given it over to writers of popular magazines. I mean, that's, you know, where a lot of us get a lot of our health information. Part of what happened was in the about the 1860s in the United States, and much earlier in Europe, there was the rise of science in medicine. And looking at all aspects of health, and especially women's health, from the aspect of science and you know, figuring out what works and what makes things happen on a scientific basis. And with the scientification of medicine, it again changed. It sort of purged the culture of a lot of that traditional healing knowledge and wisdom, and it wasn't passed on any longer. It was the power of it was taken away for a lot of people. And that happened, interestingly enough, in the United States, it really didn't, there was a lot more choices of what kind of healer you could see before the 1860s when the American Medical Association started rising in power. And at that time, they began a major campaign to, one, make it legal for only them to perform medical procedures, medical examinations, prescribe medications, that you had to go through an AMA-accredited school to get a license. They worked together with the states on legislating all this, and at that time there was a big drop. From that time on, we've seen the American Medical Association sort of take over all of our medical things in this country. And it isn't all that long ago that that happened, but it's really made a big difference, I think, in how we've gotten healthcare information. I don't have slides, but I do have a number of different handouts to hand around with some pictures. And to look at sort of what happened gynecologically speaking when men were doing women's health care. And that started, of course, long, long, long ago with the Romans and the Greeks. And I have some interesting pictures of some speculums, actually, that were found in Pompeii. They are the most hideous things you've ever seen in your life. One of the things about preparing for this talk, I did do some reading on the history of gynecology. And the books made me physically sick to look at. I mean, the pictures were so outrageously horrible. I mean, what people have done to women. I mean, I think we all don't feel comfortable seeing gynecologists or having any gynecological procedure done. But when you see what people have been through in the past, you know, we've really come a long way. And I'm much happier to be a woman right now than at any other time in history. So you can look at these pictures. And on the back side, there's some pictures of devices that they use to instill different medications in women's vaginas, which are also some of the most hideous things you may ever want to see. One is it's like a metal, I don't know even how to describe it, but anyway, they put herbal medications in it and put that up into people's vaginas. The other one's actually a steam device, so they instilled medicated steam into people's vaginas. And the other thing they talked about was using leeches for different bleeding disorders and putting leeches on people's vaginas and on their cervixes. You know, the things that we deal with are maybe not quite so horrible. Go ahead.
I have an insert here. Mm-hmm. They have found out that the saliva of leeches actually lowers high blood pressure.
You know, there are a number of indicated medical usages now for leeches. To my knowledge, there are none in gynecology, and I don't think I'd be comfortable having one of those inside of me, but yeah.
It was interesting.
Right. They use them, I think, in skin grafting.
Still use them quite a bit.
Yeah. Yeah, so you know that's the one place where I know that there are some indications. Yeah, and if people have comments to make as I talk, you know, feel free to say something. So, and this is then some pictures of some of the early gynecological exams. It was very interesting, especially in Western cultures. There was a long period of time where that speculums were not used. They were apparently used in Pompeii, but there was a long period of time where they were not used in exams. And all the exams were done blindly, basically, and you can see that on these pictures. Basically, they just sort of put their hands up people's skirts, and they didn't see anything. It was all by feel, and we still do a lot. There's still a lot of information we get from doing that in an exam. But part of the reason they did that was not because of sort of a Victorian mentality of not feeling comfortable seeing women's genitals. Women certainly never saw them, and men didn't feel very comfortable seeing them either. And there was a big controversy in the 1860s in the medical community about whether or not to use speculums. And they said that it was not appropriate at all to ever use it on someone who was not married, no matter what the medical problem, someone who had not had children. They should never use a speculum on someone who had not had children. And for married women, maybe it was okay. And is it on the back? No, it's on the back of this one. Then I have some, go ahead.
This looks a little kinky.
Yeah. Yeah, doesn't it? Yeah. I mean, it's just really, really bizarre to think about having exams done that way. And then these are some pictures of some early exam tables. I mean, people come to my office, and of course, the first thing they see is this huge exam table, and so I always get comments about, you know, how much they hate it, or can't we do something different with this? So these are some other ideas. One's this great-looking armchair that kind of, you crank a crank, and it turns into this big exam table. And I don't know if that's more appealing or not, but you can imagine sort of Victorian ladies coming in and trying to completely ignore what's about to happen to them and have this different thing. The other side of this shows, again, how we're better off than we were. There was a long period of time where surgery was basically a, especially gynecologic surgery, was a prescription for, you know, next thing would be an autopsy. I mean, there was a terrible success rate, basically, with those early surgeries. And because of bleeding, because of infection, because of the tools that they used. And so some of these are, the other side of this shows some pictures of women with ovarian cysts. Now, with ovarian cysts these days, if they get any larger than about the size of your fist, they'll probably take them out because they're worried about them becoming cancerous. So if you can look at these pictures and imagine what, and when they get about that size, people start feeling some pain and some pressure. And that can be, they can be normal, what we call physiological cysts, or other things caused by other conditions that aren't cancerous, and we still take them out. These pictures, you can see nobody took these ovarian cysts out. And you can imagine, I mean, there are a lot of real simple gynecological problems that a vast number of women must have suffered from, but there was no recourse. There was nothing that could be done. And I think there was certainly a limitation on what traditional healers could do in terms of, you know, I think they focused on childbirth. But a real common problem for older women, and especially women who have had a number of children, is prolapse of the uterus, where the uterus starts descending. I mean, the muscles just aren't there any longer to support that. There were a number of pictures from other books that I saw where, you know, they had devised all kinds of strange devices to try and hold that. We still do use what are called pessaries to help hold the uterus in place, but they had no real surgical recourse, and so they used those. They tried developing a lot of different pretty archaic and torturous-looking devices to do that. So, and again, this is just to give you an idea that we have, things are a little bit better, you know. I think, you know, there are a lot of benefits to modern medicine. I think it's really still important to continue to question modern medicine all the time, but to have a recognition that, like in all other parts of medicine, we've gone a long way. Yes?
Would you explain your position? What is a nurse practitioner?
A nurse practitioner is something that developed, and I'll be talking about this in a few minutes, but I'm a registered nurse that went on to advanced training, and officially our position sort of within the medical community is to provide well women care. We've learned some of the basics of gynecology and obstetrical care, and other nurse practitioners have other areas of specialization, but to be able to look for normal and know what normal is and be able to say this isn't normal, this is outside my ability to treat or to diagnose, and to refer people on to physicians. But I think nursing in general comes out of a perspective of trying to promote health and trying to promote prevention, and where medicine has at least traditionally come out of a perspective of dealing with illness and treating illness. I think some of that's changing in medicine, and there are finer and finer lines sort of between what a lot of nurse practitioners do and what a lot of physicians do, and depends, I think, on different people's personal philosophies. But so I see women for their annual exams, for minor gynecological problems. Actually, where I work at Group Health, I'm sort of the doorkeeper to the gynecologist, so anybody with any kind of problem, unless they're frankly bleeding so much they need to go to the emergency room, come and see me, and then I refer them on to the gynecologist. So that's kind of my position. And it's different in different states. It's licensed differently, and you have different authority in different states, too. So does that answer your question?
Yeah.
Okay. In the 1940s, let me go back to the 1850s. In the 1850s, things changed somewhat because there was the development of a couple of major advances. One was the discovery of asepsis, or that germs caused infection, which was, you know, a major change in the way that the world lived. And That certainly made a difference for gynecologists and in treating people and in doing surgery. People no longer would, if they managed to survive the surgery, then die of a major infection. There weren't antibiotics, but at least they understood that you couldn't operate with dirty instruments in a dirty room using dirty hands. And then there was also the development of anesthesia. Ether was introduced in the 1850s, and so no longer were people having to have surgeries without any kind of anesthesia. And then the other thing that happened about that time, because of the knowledge of asepsis and the fact that germs were the basis of disease, it started making a difference too in how people perceived the medical community, and gave doctors a lot more status, because here they finally had an area where they could say, yes, we do have information, and this does make a difference in our outcomes when we treat people, and we can treat them better than these traditional healers because we have these new modern methods. So that started making a difference in people's perception too. In the 1940s, and I know I'm skipping a big chunk here, and actually, you know, there were slow developments, but one of the big developments in terms of how we started doing medicine differently, gynecologically speaking, was in the 1940s, they developed the pap smear. And we started then doing things for women for prevention reasons rather than for treatment reasons. Up to that point, people mostly saw their gynecologist if they had a problem or if they were pregnant, but not for a prevention reason. And with the development of the pap smear, where we could begin to screen for early screening for cervical cancer, we started doing pap smears. And that has reduced the rate of cervical cancer by 70%. So it's been a really big innovation, and it's probably actually reduced it more. We now think that cervical cancer is caused by a virus that's sexually transmitted. And we're not, I don't think anybody's ready to say that that's absolutely the only cause of cervical cancer, but that most cervical cancers are associated with this virus. It's the virus that causes genital warts, the human papillomavirus. And by doing the pap smear, we are able to screen for changes in the cervical cells that tell us that it's been affected by this virus. And so that's been a big advance. Probably the next biggest advance came in the 1970s, when there really was a long overdue feminist revolution in women's healthcare, where women became very angry. Part of that came from the pill being introduced in the 60s. And then by the early 70s, many women having serious medical problems with the pill, and a public outcry against how this had been used, you know, experimented. Basically, women were, the FDA approved a medication that they did not know certainly all the side effects of, and only later became aware of the number of women that died from strokes and heart attacks related to birth control pill use. And that, and just sort of the beginning of the feminist revolution in this country. And that made a big difference in how women viewed their health care and what they felt comfortable doing and what they felt comfortable asking for from their providers. And I don't know how many of you remember any of this. There was a big self-help movement at that time, and there were actually clinics that taught women how to do their own pelvic exams and take a look at their cervixes. I have a tape here if anybody's interested about how to perform your own speculum exam.
On yourself.
And I actually have a plastic speculum here that was sent to me with this tape telling you how to do it. You do it with a mirror. The whole idea was taking back something from the medical establishment and saying, you know, this is my body and I want to be able to look at my own cervix and I want to be able to tell things about my own vagina, and I'm not any longer going to allow you to take total control of my body. I'm going to do this myself. I have a book at home that I didn't bring that's entitled How to Stay Out of the Gynecologist's Office, and it shows what different kinds of vaginal discharge looks like and how you can look at it yourself at home and decide what you have, and then some self-help kind of therapies you can use for yourself. So, you know, it was a sort of a radical shift from how giving all of the responsibility for our care to the physicians to taking back some of that care ourselves. Ingrid, how do you say Ingrid's last name? Kretzmann?
Chris Johnson.
Gave a talk about this. She was involved in this movement in the 70s in Chicago. Part of that movement also, women learned to do abortions when abortion was still illegal, and there was a project called the Jane Project where they actually did abortions for each other. And it was the only safe way for women at that time to get abortions, because you couldn't necessarily count on the safety of other illegal abortion practitioners. And however you feel about abortion, you know, it's a very interesting thing that at one time women did do abortions for each other, And there are now technologies that women have studied, and they're printed up. There's a new version of the book, How to Stay Out of the Gynecologist's Office, entitled A New View of Women's Bodies. And they have step-by-step instructions on how, not necessarily for you to do your own abortion, but together with someone else do an abortion. And that's being developed in response to people's fears that abortion will become illegal. And rather than put it back into the hands of unscrupulous providers who could easily kill or hurt women, that, you know, if women want that done, that there will be some place where that can happen. So, I mean, I think that the efforts to stop legal abortion would certainly not stop abortion in this country, and I'll talk a little bit more about that on Thursday. You know, that's something that's possible to do with pretty simple technology. I think currently I see some sort of the backlash against feminism in the fact that in the 70s women did know a lot about their bodies, and I think a lot of women who grow up who are about my age know a lot more than women who grew up in the 80s. And again, I'm not sure if things aren't being taught in schools or, you know, I don't know where this comes from, but the young women I see just don't know as much. There are a couple of trends that I see that may counter that in the next few years, and that's that HIV is on the rise in women. That's where the fastest growing, I'm not sure quite how to say this, HIV is growing faster in women than in any other population right now. I mean, women are rapidly becoming a high-risk group for HIV. And also because with baby boomers having a lot of kids, there's been a lot of information around childbearing, child rearing. A lot of women have taken that information back from the medical community with midwifery and home births. But that's changing somewhat, too. I mean, I think there was a big movement for a period of time for midwifery and home births, and a lot of women now feel more comfortable again with an obstetrician and not with a midwife, and want more medication in the birth process and instead of less natural childbirth. And the other area where there's going to be a big change with this is a lot of baby boomers are approaching menopause. Mm-hmm. And that's making a real big difference because, again, those same women who used to demand information about, who wanted to do their own cervical exams, their own speculum exams, are now, again, in a position of saying, look, there's no information out there about menopause. No one's talking about this. No one's researching this enough. And those same women are making the same sort of angry kinds of demands in the medical system, and things are going to change because of that. So that's kind of my review of the history. I don't know if people have any comments at this point or questions that they want to raise about this. What I'm going to do is move on then to just sort of talk about what I do in an exam, and then I really encourage you to ask questions about things if you've always wanted to know why they do this or what we're doing, and I have some examples of a number of different things used in the exam, so we can talk about that. I apologize to people if they know a lot of this information and it's a review, or if it's too technical because you've never heard of it. It's hard to know what the audience is going to be like here and what level of knowledge people have about this. So if I, you know, don't answer your questions, please feel free to bring those up or at another point. Well, when you come in for your annual exam, you're always asked to fill out a long history form, and probably people get pretty bored with that. I think it's important to know that when practitioners see you for any reason, 80% of the information that we need to make a diagnosis or to tell you about what's going on with yourself, we get from your history. So it's really important to give an accurate history and to think of, you know, whatever thing, even if you don't think it's very important, to bring that up. And then from there, we go on and do a thyroid exam. We listen to your heart and your lungs. Anybody's interested, I don't know if anybody's had an opportunity to use a stethoscope, so I brought a stethoscope along. If anybody wants to listen to it. My 2-year-old daughter's already very adept at using stethoscope. She loves to listen to her own heart and to her puppy's heart and to our hearts and stuff. So anyway, that's so many of this stuff feels so foreign because you never get to touch it, you never get to see it. And I think it leads, when you go into the doctor's office, it makes you feel like, you know, you don't have any control in this situation. Somebody else has a lot of power because you don't even know what this stuff is or what it's used for. So that's one of the reasons why I'm doing this talk and hope you feel comfortable using some of this stuff. And after we do your heart and lungs, we usually do a breast exam. I'm going to pass around. I'm not going to really teach breast exam tonight. Next week I'm doing a talk on breast health care and cardiovascular health for women, and I'll be teaching breast exam at that time. But I'm going to pass this around. I'm sure you've all seen it a million times. You know you should be doing your breast exams, and you aren't. But I'll pass this around. I always get the comment, it's sort of like, you know, the same as flossing my teeth. No, I know I'm supposed to do that, but I don't ever do it. And the other side, which I think is really helpful, is a picture of a cutaway of a breast to give you an idea of why it is that your breast always feels so lumpy. You know, people always go, when I feel my breast, it always feels full of lumps, so I don't want to do my exam. All women's breasts are like lumpy oatmeal. You will always feel lumps and bumps in your breast. There's no way of getting around it. And what you need to do is memorize what's normal for you and get to know what the normal consistency of the tissue in your breast is like, so that you can tell if there's ever a change. If you only do your breast exam once or twice a year because you're too terrified of doing it more often, which a lot of people are, you will never know what your breasts feel like on a regular basis. You'll never be able to memorize what's there. Every time you touch your breast, you're going to go, this is too weird, I'm never doing it again. I can almost guarantee you, if you do your breast exam once a month for 3 months in a row, you'll start feeling like you do know what is normal for you. And also, when you do your exam, to think instead of you're looking for cancer, I mean, I don't think that's a very motivating thing to do, you know. Instead, tell yourself your breast is healthy and normal, and you're checking it to see what it feels like, and you're memorizing that, and every month you're going to do exactly the same thing and memorize it again. A couple of little self-help tips for people. If you have, did it go all the way around?
No.
Oh, I'm sorry. That's okay. If you have problems with breast tenderness right before your periods, a couple of vitamin supplements that I give to patients that help them a lot, vitamin E, 400 milligrams a day, and vitamin B6, 50 milligrams a day, have really helped a lot of patients that I see who have a lot of problems with breast tenderness. And the other thing is, if you have fibrocystic breasts, and you've probably heard this from other people, to cut down on your intake of caffeine. What that does is just increase the fibrous tissue that's in your breast. It makes it more stiff, and so it makes it more possible to feel all that stuff in there. There's a lot of controversy whether or not decreasing your caffeine works or not, helps or not. It's helped a number of my patients. I can't say it's helped all of them, but that's one idea.
What's a normal range for having your period?
Anywhere from, and we count from the first day of your period to the first day of your period, and a lot of women count from the last day of their period to the first day of their period. Anything shorter than 21 days could possibly be a problem. And again, if your normal cycle is every 20 days, and it's always been every 20 days, I wouldn't worry about that. But if it's, you know, suddenly becomes less than that, that's potentially a problem.
Well, mine has shortened considerably since I finished with chemotherapy treatment. Mm-hmm. I noticed it's shooting back to like 21 to 23 days.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's a problem for my husband when I...
Hey, grouchy.
But I just wondered if that's...
Yeah, that's normal. I can talk a little bit about that and what happens with your period. The things that cause you to have a period, and this gets pretty complicated, and I can pass this around too. I don't know if this will be more helpful, but the it's all a lot of medical gibberish to most people, but basically the signals that signal you to have a period starts up in your brain and your hypothalamus, and that has a lot to do, that's very affected by not only, and then it affects your anterior pituitary gland. That's not only affected by, it's both a nervous system organ and a glandular organ. So it produces hormones in response to nervous system signals. So any kind of stress, and certainly chemotherapy is a physical stress and probably an emotional stress, those things can change what your cycle is like. And the part of your cycle that changes is the part before you ovulate. Usually women ovulate about 14 days into their cycle. 14 days before you start your period is when most women ovulate. But the part between the time that the whole process gears up and the time you ovulate can be shorter or longer, and that's the part that varies for most people's cycles. At the point then that you ovulate, from that point until the time you have your period is 14 days, and that's very standard for most women, 12 to 14 days. But the other part, that first part where the lining is building up in your uterus, That is the part that varies widely and can vary widely from month to month on the basis of, again, stress, illness, you name it, it can affect your cycle. But again, I can't speak specifically to your problem without knowing maybe a little bit more about it. But okay, we were on the breast exam. Oh, I wanted to make a little plug here for calcium. As long as there are some young women, most of you, sadly, are probably almost already too old. The thing that I'm most concerned about for young women especially is the amount of calcium in their diet. Those of you who are older and have started experiencing some of the side effects of osteoporosis, women after the age of menopause start losing bone mass, and that translates for a lot of women eventually into broken hips, into the dowager hump that we see with a lot of older women. And unfortunately, those broken hips translate into loss of freedom, loss of control, and oftentimes mean the rest of a life spent in a nursing home and an earlier death. The only way that can be prevented, we don't have great drugs to treat that once you're over the age of menopause. We give hormones to stop that process, but the best way to prevent it is before the age of 35 to have built up very, very solid bones, very dense bones. The only way to do that is to increase the amount of calcium you get in your diet. So I always sort of consider myself the ultimate mom in sort of warning people about all these things. That's what my job feels like frequently. And is, you know, increase your calcium. You should be getting about 1,000 milligrams of calcium a day in your diet. And this is a chart that tells you what different foods contain in terms of how much calcium. It also shows you what happens to your bone. You can probably even see this from the back. But that's what we talk about with osteoporosis. All of you are at risk because white women are very much at risk for osteoporosis. Family history makes a big difference. If you have moms or grandmas who have had this problem, you're at more risk. If you smoke, if you drink alcohol, and if you're sedentary, if you don't do very much weight-bearing exercise, you're also at more risk. All those things contribute to building stronger bones.
If you're over 35, mm-hmm. I mean, I guess what I've been hearing was
drink it anyway. Right, exactly. I mean, it's not going to make a big difference in terms, because you're already starting to lose some of your bone mass.
Okay.
But, you know, you can prevent more accelerated loss of bone mass, but you're not, you know, it's too late to sort of establish that real heavy density of bone mass. Women who are not at very much risk for this are black women, and genetically, for some reason, they make much denser bone. Similarly, men make much denser bone. They start losing bone as well, and it's not by exactly the same process, but they also have much denser bone to begin with. This is some information on that. Let's see. Well, now we're to the meat here of the subject. I don't know if that's the right word to use.
Oh, that was horrible.
And I've got some special ones here because I know everybody loves them so much. My husband thought he'd lost the box that these all came in, and then we discovered it on the loading dock, and we thought it was going to end up in the kitchen, and we thought they'd be so surprised to open up this box full of speculums and birth control devices and all the other stuff I've brought to illustrate my lectures. So. But anyway, these are speculums, and the two kinds you probably see most frequently are the metal ones and the plastic ones. And people who have been to one practitioner who uses a metal one always ask me when I, no, people who have been, had plastic ones used in the past always ask me why I'm not using a plastic one, because they for some reason think they're so much better than metal ones.
They're not as cold.
Well, that's not necessarily true. I'll tell you my disadvantage. Okay, if you see somebody uses a plastic speculum, here's my other little campaign. Tell them to quit using them, buy an autoclave, and start sterilizing their metal ones, because this is just another thing that's going to end up in the landfill forever and ever and ever and ever. They use them once and they throw them away. Yeah. They don't clean them. No, nope. They can't sterilize them. They'll melt down. The other thing about them is, in my opinion, I haven't used them as much, but I find them much more difficult to work, and I think that means you're much more apt to get pinched. I just personally feel much more uncomfortable with them. This is what they sound like. To explain what we do with these, look, here's the little bad diagram I drew here of your internal organs, or our internal organs. This gets put into your vagina, and people always go, "Why? You know, why do we have to do this?" I'm sure, you know, definitely a man designed this. I mean, there's no question about it. But I can't think of a better way to do this. Unfortunately, if anybody here feels like, you know, making $1 million, if you can come up with a better way of doing this exam, I'm sure someone would be happy to pay you for it. But and the other thing is the position you have to be in. And that's something we can certainly talk about. It's certainly not an empowering position for people. And for anybody who's been sexually abused or raped, it certainly kind of brings all that back. I mean, it's a horrible position to put people in. And again, if you can help me think of a better position to put people in, I think that's one of the reasons the self-help movement focused on women doing their own cervical exams. I mean, there at least you have some control. You're doing the same thing, but you have some control over it. But, you know, I thought of, okay, someone could stand up and I could lie on the floor and look up, but I mean, that's still not gonna, you know, really do it. And what we're looking for when we do this is we're looking for your cervix, and this is kind of the view that I have if I'm looking at it with the speculum, and basically what I do is this, and then I'm looking down and I can see your cervix. Your cervix is the opening here to your uterus. And why is the cervix such a big deal? Why did self-help groups wanna look at it? Why do we wanna look at it? Well, that's where we do the pap smear. I'll pass around, here's my other doob here. I'll pass around that we use a slide. What we do is we get a scraping of cells from the cervix. I don't seem to have those little things. We use either a brush or a little wooden stick, and we scrape the cells off the edge of your cervix right here. What we do with that, I'll pass around a thing here that describes what we see with the cells and what we're looking for and what an abnormal pap smear would be. And again, we're looking for variations that would suggest to us that perhaps there's a change going on there that could eventually lead to cancer. And so we want to get to the cervix and see what's going on with that. And that's because we're so focused on cervical cancer. It also gives us an idea of other kinds of infections and what your vagina looks like or what your cervix looks like at any given time. So the sounds that you hear, I always sort of demonstrate these for patients because they make such horrible sounds. You can start passing one of these around. There are different sizes you can see. This one I use on women who have never had children. This gets used on women who have had children. Usually the muscles, the pelvic muscles, are much more relaxed. And so if I were to insert a speculum like this in, the vagina tends to fold down around it and I can't see the cervix. I think it's important to look at these and recognize that the diameter really is no bigger than like a major size tampon. It's certainly no bigger than an erect penis. So I mean, we're not talking about a big thing that we're sticking in your vagina. I think most people think this whole thing's going in there. It's just this part right here. Not the diameter. Okay. And what we do with this is after we insert it in, and if you're cold, and speaking of cold, Barbara, okay, the two ways you can keep this from being cold, very simple. All they have to do is run it under warm water.
You're not supposed to use my name because it's on the tape.
Oh, sorry, sorry. Or run it under warm water, or it can sit on a heating pad. And a lot of practitioners do that too, and it doesn't have to be cold. And if your practitioner uses a cold speculum, you have, you know, my permission, if you need someone's permission, to say to them, hey, warm that thing up. And if it's too warm, tell them it's too warm. I mean, because that's the other thing. Sometimes if the water gets too hot, you know, it can get too warm. But we push on this little lever here. I'll pass this plastic one around, too. You can see how much harder it is to kind of deal with. And then there's a screw right here that we screw to keep it open like this while I do what I need to do. And that's what you hear when we're doing this. And then at that point, I would insert whatever thing I'm using to get at the cervix. This is a swab that we use to just remove some of the discharge. There's a lot of normal vaginal discharge that needs to get removed before I can take the sample. And there are other culture tubes, and I'll pass these different things around. And you can just play with them and take them apart and do whatever you want with them. And take one home and throw it at your gynecologist if you want. And then this is the pap slide. You've probably all seen people take, okay, they do something magical over here. You're over there, you don't know what they're doing. They take this little scraper or the little brush, they rub it on this slide to try and thin out the layer of cells that they've just gotten. and then they spray it with basically hairspray. If you're hearing this psh, 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 and you don't know what that is, it's hairspray to fix those cells and keep them looking just like they look, so that it'll last a day or two or three, however long it takes to get to the lab, so that they can look it under the microscope.
You keep talking about going to a gynecologist.
Or a nurse practitioner.
How do you feel about just having this sort of exam done just with a general gynecologist practitioner?
That's not necessary
if you go to specialists?
Not at all. Depends on how comfortable they are with doing it. I mean, I certainly have, I see in my clinic, there are a lot of male physicians in my clinic, and those are their women's primary physicians, but they don't feel comfortable going to their male physician for their annual exam, and they come to me for that. So, one of the other things that that can help people feel maybe a little bit more control over this whole thing is, and that's just learning to know your own genital area and your vagina and your cervix. It's especially important if you're using a barrier method of birth control, a diaphragm or a cervical cap. A lot of women don't feel comfortable, have been taught they're not supposed to touch themselves there, but you know, this is part of your body, and I think the disservice that's been done to women is we've made them believe that only certain men, their partners or their physicians, have access to that part of their body. But it is your body, and it's kind of exciting to get to know that part of your body if you've never done that before. The vagina, as you can see, I get a number of women who come in and think they've lost a tampon, and they're kind of afraid that it's like going to go somewhere inside of them and it'll cause some horrible problem. Well, the vagina is a very self-contained little pocket right here that sits outside the cervix. The opening to the cervix is very small, and nothing's going to get back up in here other than bugs and germs. No tampon's going to get in there. This is usually what the opening to your cervix looks like, a little dot. This would be in women who have had children, because the cervix, this little dot, has to expand to be 10 centimeters in size. So when they talk about somebody getting to 10 before they start pushing, this is what has to get to 10, so that it's big enough for the baby's head to come through. If people start pushing before that point, they could rip that tissue, and that's why they make you wait. And that's what hurts in labor, is the stretching of this opening. And that's why gynecological procedures that involve stretching that opening hurt. For example, DNCs or IUD insertion or something like that, because they have to stretch that opening, those muscles will cramp and hurt. I was talking about feeling your vagina. Okay. The walls of your vagina are soft. They feel like your cheeks. So if you've got a finger in your vagina, you're trying to figure out what it is that you're feeling, which most of my patients don't know what it is they're feeling for good reason. They've never felt it before. Why would they know? Feel like your cheeks, and at the end, you'll feel what feels like the end of your nose. That's your cervix, and with a little dimple in the middle of it. You know, it's kind of revolutionary to realize, you know, that all those internal organs are really all in there, you know, and then you kind of have access to them with your hand. It's great. So. I encourage people to do that. You can't feel much more of this stuff. Your uterus actually is about the size of a small light bulb, if it's not pregnant. And your ovaries are about the size of almonds. And so they can get larger and smaller in relation to your menstrual cycle. Usually with the exam, after we do the part of the exam with the speculum, we do the bimanual exam, where we stick a couple fingers inside the vagina and then your hand on top. We're feeling for the size and shape of your uterus. Because if it was large, there could be potentially some problems there, or the size and shape of your ovaries. We're trying to rule out, you know, huge tumors. The reality is, especially with ovarian cancer, I'm sure you're aware of this with people like Gilda Radner, who at a very young age contracted ovarian cancer and died. It's very difficult to find an ovarian cancer early enough to make a difference. Some of that's changing a bit, but it's a dangerous cancer, but we hope always to be able to look for that when we're doing our annual exam with that bimanual exam.
I have a question. Mm-hmm. And this is just, I had to have a sonogram for something. Mm-hmm. And I noticed as she was on the screen that my ovaries were, like, one was twice as big as the other.
Mm-hmm. And that'll happen.
Normal?
Yeah. Okay. It can happen. And if she would have done that exam a month later, it could have looked exactly opposite.
Even if you're on birth control pills?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Birth control pills usually cut down the number of what we call physiologic cysts. Mm-hmm. What happens is every month when you produce an egg, you make like a cyst on the side of the ovary where that egg is growing and maturing. Mm-hmm. That egg gets released at the time of ovulation, and that cyst can stay there then through the rest of that cycle. and then gradually regress and get smaller and smaller and smaller. But it can make your ovary twice the size of the other one.
You shouldn't ovulate.
Right, but it still, people can still develop those cysts even on the birth control pill. It doesn't happen as often, but it can happen. Usually people on birth control pills, they like to watch them more closely if they notice that happening, be sure that it isn't something abnormal. Mm-hmm. You know, it is possible for it to happen and for it to be normal. And what happens is you ovulate from every other ovary every other month. So, or in the best of all possible perfect physiologic worlds, I suppose you ovulate every other month. The only other thing I wanted to talk about, we're fastly running out of time. I was just going to give a couple of self-help ideas for vaginitis and a couple of ideas for vaginal infections. You're probably all aware of the over-the-counter sale now of yeast infection medications, mm-hmm. which is great, except it costs about $18, and they doubled like the price of this when they put it over the counter. But you can use a couple of other simple things that will usually take care of a yeast infection. Actually, there's a study that's been done on people who have had recurrent yeast infections that didn't respond to any medications at all. They used boric acid, which you can buy in any drugstore for, I don't even know, it's extremely cheap. Buy some gelatin capsules, number one size gelatin capsules, fill them with boric acid, put those in your vagina every night for 3 nights in a row, and in people who had recurrent yeast infections, it completely stop their yeast infection. I use it for people who are on birth control pills and have frequent yeast infections, or for some reason at some point in their life have a frequent yeast infection, who are on a long-term antibiotic use. Have them use it once or twice a week to prevent the development of yeast infections. It changes the pH balance, the acid-base balance in your vagina, makes it an environment where the yeast organisms don't want to grow, as opposed to the fungal medications like Monistat and all those things you buy over the counter, which kill the yeast but don't do anything to change the environment, so the yeast can just come right back. You always have yeast in your system. Mm-hmm. The other thing that there was a study done this last year on eating yogurt, 8 ounces of yogurt with active acidophilus culture. Eating 8 ounces of yogurt with active acidophilus culture every day has been shown to decrease the incidence of yeast infections as well. So that's another idea. The other thing that's been done recently, some research, again, it's sort of like science is finally catching up with some of the things that women have done for themselves for a long time. They researched what happens with douching. They no longer suggest that douching is a good idea for a couple of reasons. They've shown, number one, women who douche frequently have more frequent and more severe vaginal infections than women who don't. The reason for that is you change that normal pH balance in your vagina, and so you're more likely to get a vaginal infection. Secondly, because of the flushing action, you're pushing water up and potentially can push it up into your uterus and up into your fallopian tubes. If you've got an infection in your vagina, you can push it up higher into the whole reproductive tract and get a more serious infection. It's been linked to higher rates of ectopic pregnancies. And so if you're douching, you can stop. And if you are, never use anything other than vinegar and water. Anything else is like writing yourself a prescription for a vaginal infection. So, because that's, again, about the same acid-base balance. So.
Are most of the yogurts that you buy over-the-counter active?
No, there aren't very many, and it varies from community to community what kinds are. And you might even want to call, you know, if you have an extension agency or something like that, agricultural extension agency, and ask them. Or if you go to a health food store and you feel like you can trust them, ask them what brands have an active culture. In them. Some of them say active culture, and there's some research that's been done on that. You know, it's real interesting. There's a woman at the University of Washington who's doing a lot of research right now on the bacteria in yogurt, lactobacillus, and what that does in your vagina. You usually have lactobacillus in your vagina, and that lactobacillus produces hydrogen peroxide, and they think they've associated healthy vaginas with lactobacillus that produce hydrogen peroxide, unhealthy vaginas with lactobacillus that doesn't produce hydrogen peroxide. So they know that lactobacillus is really important, but they haven't found a way yet to get active lactobacillus into your vagina and keep it there. I mean, they can introduce it, but you're just going to shed it. So they're still working on it. But I think it's encouraging that there are women doing this kind of research who are aware that, you know, that vaginitis is a big problem for women, and that you know, a lot of visits are for that. So, well, I've talked way too much, and I'm sorry. So if anybody has questions or comments, or I have some questions to ask if people don't have questions. And does anybody want to talk about your best or your worst experience with a gynecological exam, and you know, maybe analyze that a little bit about why it was bad or why it was good? Is that anything you want to talk about?
My question is unrelated.
Okay, that's fine.
I'm wondering about the direction of the uterus.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, people have been told frequently that their uteruses are tipped one way or another. Sometimes you get comments with that, like, oh my gosh, your uterus is, you know, I mean, some kind of pejorative comment that there's something terribly wrong with your uterus. It's the same as if, you know, you have earlobes that are attached or not attached. The uterus can tip in the body towards the front, towards the back, or can be straight up and down, and almost any position in between. It can be almost folded over on itself, either forward or backward. All of those positions are normal. Probably won't make any difference in becoming pregnant. That's the thing that frequently women have been told, oh, your uterus is tipped, you're going to have trouble getting pregnant. I don't think there are any statistics to back that up. Okay. It's just one of those things that I don't know how it was determined, but you know, I think gynecologists for a long time had a vision of what was supposed to be normal, and if you didn't fit that, then go ahead.
Do doctors know that? I'm being facetious. I want to know how you identify yeast infections.
How you identify yeast infections? We look at the discharge and also your symptoms. Yeast infections usually itch like crazy, usually that's what brings people into the office, is that they're going absolutely nuts with this itch. They don't always itch a lot, but the discharge is usually curdy. They talk about it being like cottage cheese. And sometimes you never even see any discharge, you just have a really bad itch. They usually don't have an odor, or if they do, it's a yeasty odor, like fresh bread. And that's as opposed to another real common kind of infection called bacterial vaginosis or Gardnerella, which usually produces some burning in the vagina, and you usually have a kind of fishy odor. And that's a different kind of infection and is treated differently.
What is the treatment for that one?
Well, the current treatment is a horrible medication called Flagyl. I imagine most people in this room have probably taken it at some point in time. It is a really strong antibiotic and anti-parasitic drug. It's used to treat Giardia. But this particular bacteria is a pretty hardy little one, and one of the few antibiotics it responds to is to Flagyl. The good news is that this fall there are two new medications that are supposed to be released. One is a Flagyl gel that's just put in the vagina so you don't have the systemic effects. Most people get very sick with Flagyl and has some potential birth defect potential if you're pregnant, so we don't use it in pregnancy. The other is another antibiotic called clindamycin gel. I have frequently treated women who don't have really severe symptoms. I can usually tell when I'm doing an exam just by smelling the discharge what kind of, you know, that people probably have a little bit of this stuff. But if it's not causing people a lot of problem, I usually give them some boric acid and hope to change the pH balance in their vagina a little bit. But women can have this all their lives. It's something you can grow, you can have all your life. It may not ever cause you a problem. And if you take Flagyl, you can take it 6 times in a row and still not get rid of this stuff. So, you know, I'm hesitant to use Flagyl unless someone has a real problem with it. But I sometimes get in trouble with the gynecologist for that. But that's what I like to do, is get in trouble with gynecologists. So.
Somebody at work was describing this vaginal infection that mm-hmm. she had, and she was saying the doctor had done some painting or something, and then she was saying that he was suggesting that since her husband hadn't been circumcised, that mm-hmm. he was perhaps carrying some virus mm-hmm. or something, that when they had intercourse and this was continuing. That this was continuing her vaginal
infection.
Is that, and something about painting?
Mm-hmm. It's possible. The one treatment for yeast infections is something called gentian blue. It's a dye. Mm-hmm. Now, I don't use it, and I don't know many people that do, but sometimes people use that. And uncircumcised males can have yeast beneath their foreskin, and so it's possible for them to transmit it to a partner. I mean, we don't consider it a sexually transmitted disease, but it's possible to pass that back and forth between partners. But, you know, that may be what they were talking about. I don't know of too many other, you know, when we look for the wart virus, sometimes we paint vaginas with vinegar because that will make any warty tissue stand out white. And so that's another reason why they might have done that. And certainly he could have warts. Circumcised or uncircumcised males can have warts.
Is a male that's uncircumcised often have more difficulty staying cleaner, or... And what, I mean, I know this is off the subject totally, but what's the advantage?
Of being circumcised?
Yeah, I mean, because that's the big, that was the big issue.
Yeah.
It still is.
It is a big issue. Yeah, it is a big issue. It's a big issue, and I'm not real well informed on it, but there have been some speculation that men who are not circumcised has more frequent urinary tract infections, and now they think that they're also more susceptible for a number of different sexually transmitted diseases, just because, again, it's a place where things can grow. I mean, women, and I'll talk about this on my talk on sexually transmitted diseases I do later in the week, but the vagina is like the world's best growing environment for bugs. And, you know, second best is under a foreskin of an uncircumcised penis. I mean, if they don't clean there, certainly you can get a lot of bugs growing in there.
So a woman is very much affected by whether a man is circumcised or not?
Not terribly, no. Because usually, I mean, they can't harbor that many bugs and they can't transmit that many bugs from that area. Any other questions or comments? Anyone want to talk about good experiences, bad experiences? What they've always wanted to do to their gynecologists?
The adult movie. Mm-hmm.
I do have one question, and that's just when, and this isn't just in gynecological things, but I'm one of those people who goes to my GP, and I do everything there just because it's someone I've known for 2-3 years. And that just feels easier and it's someone I'm comfortable with. But I do feel like, I mean, everybody says, stop your doctor and ask questions. And I have a really nice doctor who answers questions. But a lot of questions come up later. Mm-hmm. A lot of times, you know, like that question, I've been wondering about that for months. Mm-hmm. You know, but I didn't have a reason to go to the doctor.
And ask.
And also, I actually brought it up with the doctor at the time. Mm-hmm. And this had come back as a result from the radiologist. And they hadn't even commented on it. And so my doctor's response was, well, you know, I don't really know what that was about. I'm sure it was nothing or they would have said something. Mm-hmm. So in some ways, I've been sitting around for a couple of months going, well, what if they just didn't say something because somebody wasn't paying attention? And how do you get a doctor to stop and really answer questions? I mean, do you have recommendations working with, having a nurse practitioner?
Right. It helps somewhat. I mean, you know, frankly, it's based on how busy people are, and usually people are so busy trying to keep up with the serious stuff, it's hard to keep up with what we maybe don't view as being serious, but you certainly view as being serious because it's your body and it's what you're concerned about. Other than, I always encourage people, especially if I'm referring them on to a specialist, to write down all their questions. You know, when you get to a specialist, you're not going to have much time there in all likelihood. They may have a worse bedside manner than anybody you've seen before, you know, so write down everything that you can, you know, sit and brainstorm about any possible question you can possibly imagine. And that's the, you know, before you go answer. The after you go answer is call them up, and if they don't answer you, keep calling back. I mean, you know, eventually they're going to call you. I mean, we also have, you know, all of us have lawyers basically riding on our backs every day we practice. We're always aware of the fact that if we don't do something right, we're going to get sued. And so one of the things is if we have a good office staff who's writing down that so-and-so is calling, and if you've called 3 days in a row and those questions aren't getting answered somewhere, that's getting written down. And, you know, if for no other reason, they're going to respond to you because otherwise it's going to look really bad on paper. I mean, that's a terrible answer, but that's reality, you know. Between the constraints of trying to get all of our work done and trying to keep up with the most serious things, you know, we're also always worried about making sure that things get done so we're not going to get in trouble. But, you know, you just have to keep calling because, and you can ask. I mean, I think it's all right. I don't think you need to feel like you're asking for more than you deserve. When you say, I had this test done, if you don't know what this means, you know, could you review this with the radiologist? Or can you see me again and check my exam and see if it still feels that way, you know, in this case with an ovary that looked large? You know, come back in and say, I just want you to check my ovary again and see if it feels okay. Has this gone down in size? Should it go down in size? If it doesn't go down in size, what are you going to do about it? You know, I'm not going to say that's going to make you real popular with your physician, but or you know whoever you're seeing, but you have to take you know, unfortunately, an assertive role sometimes because we are so busy that if that doesn't happen, we're likely to let those things, you know, slip by. So
I just can't imagine, you know, telling or requesting a physician heat the specula. I mean, I know you were being semi-serious and semi-facetious, but I mean, so many women have been raised to be.
Well, you're not.
You talk about an exam. I mean, I can't believe I did this. I sat there, and the doctor did a breast exam, and I mean, I'm just absolutely appalled that I did this because his form of breast exam was dropping your rope
and just looking.
Yeah, and I was just like, why did I do this? You know, because I felt like I was being leered at, and I had never had a breast exam where they didn't. Lie you in the tail, you know, and it's.
You go back to that person?
I wouldn't go back to that person. But I mean, it was just so. And then my daughter, I mean, I took my 8-year-old daughter to. He was a 1950s kind of guy, for a rash on her back, and you know we're all into this. People don't touch you, and the whole thing. She's 8 years old, and he goes. He sort of gruffed, and he goes, you know, tear off her shirt. She looked at me, and I'm like. She goes, I don't want to. And he goes, well, how can I see your rash? You don't take off your shirt, you know, and it's like, and I'm sitting there and I'm telling her one thing and she said, I don't want to go back to him ever again. And I said, no, you don't have to. And I'm sorry that I didn't take a more assertive role. But I feel like we're teaching our daughters that.